You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Micah is one of what's called the minor prophets, not because he's less important, but simply because his is one of a dozen shorter books from prophets who were not Isaiah or Jeremiah. Much of what we know today as Micah was probably written about 800 years before Jesus' life. Judean politics, society, and worship had slid into an unjust arrangement that favored the rich. They lorded their privilege over the poor in ostentatious worship and behavior. Micah basically says, cut it out, or else. His prophecy is a rhythm between judgment and hope. Judgment and hope. And the passage we hear today has a little bit of both. The last few lines are not only sentiments that many people point to as a favorite Bible verse, but as a summary of the whole of Judeo-Christianity.
Our words of wisdom are from Micah chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. What shall I become before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before God with burnt offerings, with calves of year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give the firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul?
God has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice, and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Years ago, I wanted to preach about the dangers of legalism in the church. Without telling the congregation exactly what I was preaching on that Sunday morning, I wore a magnetic stud earring. Sheesh, people were murmuring and doing double takes. Only one woman had the gumption to come up to me and say what most of the rest of the congregation was thinking. Does your mother know you've pierced your ear? It was fun then in the sermon to take the earring off and tell the congregation that they can never look down their noses at the Pharisees again. Well, that was a lot of years ago, and now body piercings and tattoos have really become mainstream. Fact is, the hippest of Christians are sporting tattoos and piercings as a sign of solidarity with outcasts and a conviction that doing so makes them rebellious like Jesus was. One of the role models for this way of thinking is Jay Baker. He's a preacher and evangelist who has spent a lot of time processing the spiritual and psychic damage done by growing up the son of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. Likewise with Lutheran pastor Nadia Bolz Weber. Much of her shock factor approach to ministry, she loves to drop F-bombs in her talks and sermons, is aimed squarely at the fundamentalists who shamed and manipulated her as a young evangelical. And of course, then there's the guy who is so cool that he gets the verse prohibiting tattoos tattooed on his arm. Either way, my grandmother would have had a conniption. She grew up in a church where drinking, smoking, dancing, movies, makeup, jewelry, the list goes on, were not tolerated. Playing cards was a one-way ticket to hell. The religion she grew up with was all about the do's and don'ts that determined whether you were acceptable to God or not. Whatever you do, don't drink, dance, smoke, play cards, cuss, lust, steal, sleep in on Sundays, or be a Democrat. Do, pray, praise, serve, go to church often, give money to the church, love, be faithful in marriage, heterosexual only, read the Bible, and evangelize. But let me be clear. As hard as some people try to make it so, Christianity is not about following a list of do's and don'ts. It's not about being good. But here's the problem. The culture wars that are tearing our country apart right now have their roots firmly planted in this dangerous Christian idea. This focus on being good is not only misdirected into a kind of legalism that dominates people's idea of what it means to be religious, it seems to be justification in some people's minds to jump straight to declaring those who don't agree with them to be satanic, cannibalistic pedophiles. You see it every day in our politics. And come May 1st, you'll see it in the launch of a new breakaway Methodist denomination, the Global Methodist Church. This new denomination will consist of former United Methodists who simply couldn't wrap their minds around the idea that LGBTQIA people are beloved children of God. They believe these bad people need to be excluded, reprogrammed, or otherwise shamed. Why? Because being anything other than heterosexual is not their idea of good. The protracted battle over LGBTQIA rights has lasted the whole of my career as a pastor. And through most of it, I've just had to shake my head in disbelief at those who ended up in the Methodist Church, thinking that it was a place where they could count on people being good as they defined goodness. I've had to say it over and over again. I'm so sorry. You joined the wrong club. Our founder, John Wesley, broke rule after rule, from organizing people outside the church, to preaching in the fields, to sending missionaries to the colonies, to, oh my, authorizing women to preach. Now, we haven't always gotten it right. We Methodists have split over slavery, child labor, unions, women's suffrage, and civil rights, not to mention countless theological obscurities. But for the most part, I am grateful to be part of a denomination that makes it possible to change and grow, even when it means breaking the rules. One of my proudest moments in recent memory was annual conference 6 years ago. The denomination was on the verge of splitting, and rules were set in place that made it possible for Methodists anywhere in the country to bring charges against LGBTQIA clergy and those of us who were doing same-sex weddings or welcoming LGBTQIA folks into our churches. The threats were real. The consequences include being fired and losing our pensions. But in the midst of the turmoil, nothing had come to the floor as a resolution at our local annual conference. Saturday morning, I heard that New England had just passed a resolution of non-compliance. So I went to Bishop Oshibata on a break and asked, "If I draft it, will you support it?" The impish grin on his face was all the approval I needed. I wrote furiously through the lunch break and drafted a resolution that the bishop then had distributed to all the delegates for action. Our non-compliance resolution basically told the denomination that we would not participate in or conduct church trials to punish LGBTQIA persons or their allies. We said that we were committed to the biblical principles of justice and compassion, and that our current discipline is prejudiced and just plain wrong. Not only was the resolution adopted overwhelmingly by our conference, but the following month, our Western jurisdiction unanimously elected Bishop Karen Olivito as the United Methodist Church's first openly lesbian and married bishop. Subsequently, the heads of many traditional United Methodists across the globe were heard to explode. We had not met the criteria of goodness, as some people counted goodness. Worse, we were enabling badness. But here's the deal. I would argue that our badness was the kind of goodness that John Lewis called good trouble. And more importantly, it was also in line with what Jesus was on about, namely, putting people first, not rules. And when it comes to the importance of rules, I think today's passage from Micah really sums it up. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? Consider the context. Israel had lost the essence of faith. Ritual had become an end in itself. It was all about following the rules. And Micah was convinced of three things. Without justice, human beings can't live together in peace. Without kindness or mercy, life is unbearable. Mercy, grace, and kindness gives unconditionally. And humility, especially in relationship with anything having to do with the divine, is really the only way not to become a pious jerk. Look, Jesus' whole ministry was about living out Micah's call in real life. Justice, kindness, and humility, which led to his focusing on one thing, people. He was all about seeing people's needs and felt free to break rules some folks felt were at the heart of religion. Remember when Jesus got criticized for picking heads of grain to eat on the Sabbath? He said, "Rules shmules." That's in the Greek. The more stuffy translation is, "The Sabbath was made for people, not people for the Sabbath." Jesus' whole ministry was about challenging the very legalism many still place at the center of their spiritual lives. He was about moving beyond rules to relationship. We don't prove our faith by rigid compliance with rules. When I was on a work team a few years ago with about 60 teenagers, my small group was having one of those conversations you have on missions like this. I told my teammates that most of the time, because of the hateful behavior that seems to have become the norm with a lot of Christians, I didn't feel comfortable calling myself a Christian. Later, several of the kids commented on how important that idea was to them, because in their circle of friends, being a Christian is about being judgmental, homophobic, anti-science, and arrogant. But for me, and for them, being a follower of Jesus still has value. Because being a follower of Jesus means being compassionate, open, and transformative, not just a rule follower. So the problem we've got with this insistence on goodness is that it creates a wall that separates so-called good Christians from real people and the real world. And once you're in that bubble, living one's life according to a rigid set of moralistic don't do this and don't do that rules, can be a scary place full of anxiety, fear of punishment, and isolation. When I'm at my most frustrated with the hatefulness of many Christians, I try to muster up sympathy for the folks who are genuinely trapped in the conventional Christianity of moralistic rule-keeping. They don't know that there's an alternative, and they live under threat of eternal punishment for questioning the authorities in their bubble. What we know, and they can't comprehend, is that the solution is simply to stop worrying about the rules. Being a Christian is not primarily about being good. It's about taking your cue from Micah and Jesus and doing justice, loving kindness, and walking humbly with God, which along the way might just land you outside the boundaries of what some people think of as goodness. Years ago, I was in a conversation with a fundamentalist-type Christian who finally got fed up with me and said, "You know, I don't think you even believe in Jesus." And I said, "I don't. I'm in a relationship with Jesus." Right? How weird would it be if your most important relationships were measured by how much you believed in that person and followed rigid expectations of behavior. Now, while based in common values of compassion and respect, the healthiest of relationships are dynamic. They're fluid. They're full of give and take, depending on one another and flexing to adjust to circumstances as they come up. So to be a follower of Jesus means committing to a relationship, a lifelong journey. And like any relationship, it has its ups and downs. But when we are committed to living into the values that Jesus modeled, it becomes less about trying to be good and more about embracing real people in the real world. As Marcus Borg wrote, "The Christian life is not primarily about believing the right things or being good. The Christian life is about being in relationship with God, which transforms us into more and more compassionate beings, into the likeness of Christ." Baptist speaker Tony Campolo tells a story about preaching to a particularly legalistic group of Christians, and closing with this story. "Just during the course of this service, tens of thousands of children will die from starvation while we squander resources beyond most of the world's imaginations. And most of us don't even give a damn." After pausing for effect and for people to stop squirming, he continued, "You know, and the really sad part is that there are some here that are more upset about the pastor saying damn than they are about those children dying." Christians who base their whole identity on how well they follow a set of culturally created rules and believe in certain bedrock dogmas are missing out on what Jesus actually taught. It's not about believing the right stuff. It's not even primarily about being good. It's about pursuing justice, loving kindness, and humbly exploring what it means to be in a lifelong relationship with the mystery of the divine. The next time you witness a Christian demeaning another human being for not following the rules or damning someone else to hell for not believing the right things, take heart. These are the same folks who killed the prophets, damned and executed Jesus, and who, for time immemorial, have taken on the mantle of the good and the right. They will always be with us. But rest assured, being a Christian is not about being good. It's about living into the call that the Spirit has placed on our lives to love people, to heal the world, and put love first, even if it means upsetting the status quo along the way. In fact, that's the only way anything truly good has ever come about. Now, get out there. Let me see some badness.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information, or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.